helicopters. There were 1,225 buses in all, painted in a kaleidoscope of colors, representing more than a dozen different Soviet transport enterprises. Some red, some yellow, some green, and some blue, some half red, half white, others with a stripe, plus 250 trucks and other vehicles in support, including ambulances from the civil defense, repair trucks, and fuel tankers. At 2 p.m., a full day and a half after the pall of radionuclides had first begun drifting into the atmosphere, the motley caravan of vehicles waiting at the Pripyat city limits at last began to move. Maria Protsenko was waiting for them on the old railway bridge at the entrance to the city. With a map of Pripyat folded under her arm, she was dressed for the hot weather in a blouse, skirt, and summer sandals. She was joined by a major from the army and another from the police. They shook hands. They all understood what they had to do. Nobody said much. As the first bus approached, the police major waved it to a halt and Protsenko climbed aboard. She showed the driver the map and gave him his instructions. The buses were to proceed in groups of five. She told him which micro-district they should go to, how to get there, the building they should stop at, and the route they should take out of the city. Then she climbed down, the policeman waved forward another group of buses, and Protsenko showed the next driver her map. Gradually, five by five, hour by hour, she watched as each of the 1,000 vehicles drew away down the scenic incline of Lenina Prospect, and with a sharp turn and a tart belch of low-octane gasoline fumes, disappeared into the city. Outside the 540 separate entrances of its 160 apartment buildings, the citizens of Pripyat mounted the steps of their buses, and the doors banged shut behind them. At around 3 p.m., Colonel Boris Nesterov, deputy commander of the Air Forces of the Kiev Military District, a helicopter pilot with 20 years' experience who had served in Syria and seen combat in the mountains of northern Afghanistan, saw his target come into view ahead. Bringing the powerful Mi-8 transport in from the west at an altitude of 200 meters, he prepared to cut his speed as he closed in on the red and white striped vent stack of Unit 4. Behind him in the cargo compartment, the flight engineer had already slid open the side door and clipped his harness to the airframe. The pile of 10 sandbags stood ready at his feet. Nesterov slowed to 100 kilometers per hour and gave the command, "Prepare to drop!" The ruins of reactor number 4 came up fast. The colonel's headphones filled with static, the cockpit thermometer spiked abruptly from 10 to 65 degrees centigrade, and the radiometer housed in the back of his seat ran off the scale. Through the cockpit glass between his foot pedals, Nesterov saw the pillar of white vapor and the edges of the reactor glowing red, like a blast furnace during smelting. The helicopter was equipped with no bomb sights or targeting mechanisms that could help them here. To drop the sandbags into the reactor vault, the flight engineer had to aim as best he could by eye, estimate a trajectory, and shove them through the door one at a time. As he leaned out over the reactor, he was enveloped in clouds of toxic gas and blasted with waves of gamma and neutron radiation. He had no protection apart from his flight suit. The intense heat rising from below made it impossible for Nesterov to hover. If the helicopter lost forward momentum, it would be caught in the column of superheated air, its rotor blades would encounter a calamitous drop in torque, and the machine would fall abruptly out of the sky. The colonel throttled back to 60 kilometers per hour. He fought to hold the helicopter steady and hoped the flight engineer could keep his footing. "Drop!" he shouted. The engineer hefted the first of the sandbags out into the sky above Unit 4, then another and another. "The cargo has been dropped!" Nesterov swung away to starboard and prepared to come around again. At 5 p.m., Maria Protsenko folded her map, flagged down one last bus, and climbing aboard, rode it down Lenina Prospect, a lone passenger entering a deserted city. She directed the driver from one side of Pripyat to the other, stopping in each district to check on the results of her work. At 6:30, Protsenko returned to the Ispolkom to tell the mayor that her task was complete. "Vladimir Pavlovich, that's it. Everybody has been evacuated," she said. With the exception of the maintenance staff and the men left behind to tend to the surviving reactors of the power station, the city was empty. As her report was passed up the chain to the chairman of the government commission, Protsenko felt no sorrow, only the satisfaction of an important job well done. it was just as they had it in the Young Pioneers. The party speaks, and the Komsomol says, it's done. It wasn't until later that night that she began to feel sick. Her throat was raw, and she developed a blinding headache. Her feet and ankles burned and itched. She made no conscious connection to radiation, partly because she knew nothing about the effects of the radioactive alpha and beta particles in the dust that had blown around her bare legs during her hours on the railway bridge, but also because she preferred not to think about it. When the diarrhea began, Protsenko told herself she had eaten some bad cucumbers. The headaches and the sore throat, well, she had gone without sleep for 2 days. She soothed the itching by lifting her legs into the bathroom sink and running her feet under cold water. But it soon returned. Protsenko went back to her desk, where she once again took to drawing maps for the chemical troops, who were now conducting radiation surveys of the area every 60 minutes. They began sweeping the inside of the Ispolkom itself for radiation and warned her that the hallways were all contaminated. The janitor was long gone, so Protsenko took a wet cloth and mopped the linoleum herself. There were no gloves, so she used her bare hands. As the multicolored convoy of buses wound its way through the narrow roads surrounding the city, few of the departing citizens knew where they were going. Nobody had told them anything. But they were confident they would soon return. Part of the convoy was well beyond the city limits when someone realized that the vehicles were carrying dangerous levels of radioactive dust on their wheels and had to double back to Pripyat for decontamination. One member of the power station staff traveled more than 50 kilometers away from the city on a bus with his wife and children before telling them to go on alone while he returned to the plant to help his colleagues. The driver dropped him in the city of Ivankov, where he had to talk the local militia commander into allowing him to go back. Some evacuees persuaded their drivers to take them all the way to Kiev, but the Interior Ministry's plan called for everyone from Pripyat to be distributed throughout the small towns and villages of rural Polesia, where they would be taken in, one family at a time, by farmers and kolkhoz workers. Viktor Bruhanov's wife, Valentina, wept as she was driven away from the city. On Natalia Yuvchenko's bus, the passengers whispered anxiously about where they might end up. They scoured the roadsides for the names of villages as they drove on through one settlement after another, and saw the pity on the leathery faces of the peasants who stood in their yards to watch them pass. On the third floor of the White House, the meetings of the government commission continued. Downstairs, Maria Protsenko remained at her desk. It was around 8 p.m. when she glanced out of the window and noticed a woman walking across the square into town. She was alone and carrying a suitcase. Protsenko couldn't understand it. Every woman and child in the city was supposed to have been taken to safety hours ago. She dispatched a duty officer to go down and investigate and watched from her office as he stopped the woman and questioned her. They talked, the woman nodded, and then carried on as before, taking her suitcase with her. When the guard returned, Protsenko discovered that word of the emergency in Pripyat had apparently not yet prevented the trains passing through the railway station from stopping there on their normal timetable. The woman was returning from a weekend away and alighted from the train from Khmelnytsky, 300 kilometers away to the southwest, with no reason to believe that anything had changed in her absence. When the security guard explained to her what had happened, she seemed neither frightened nor panicked. Of course she would agree to be evacuated, she told him. But first, I'm going home. Yet, as the woman carried her suitcase back to her apartment building, she found Pripyat eerily transformed. In the space of just a few hours, Viktor Bruhanov's beloved city of the future had become a ghost town. Abandoned laundry flapped in the breeze on the balconies of Lenina Prospect. The beaches were deserted, the restaurants empty, the playgrounds silent. Now the streets echoed with new sounds, the barking of bewildered pet dogs, their fur so contaminated with poisonous dust that their owners had been forced to leave them behind, the whine of civil defense reconnaissance vehicles, and the relentless throb of helicopter engines as the pilots and engineers of the 51st Guards Helicopter Regiment returned again and again to fling bags of boron and sand into the mouth of the radioactive volcano. Part 2. Death of an Empire. 10. The Cloud. Lifted skyward on a pillar of fierce heat from the shattered core, Convoyed by obliging winds, the invisible cloud of radiation had traveled thousands of kilometers since its escape from the carcass of Unit 4. Unleashed in the violence of the explosion, it had soared aloft into the still night air until it reached an altitude of around 1,500 meters, where it was snatched by powerful wind currents blowing from the south and southeast, pulled away at speeds of between 50 and 100 kilometers an hour, and flew northwest across the USSR toward the Baltic Sea. The cloud carried gaseous xenon-133, microscopic fragments of irradiated graphite, and particles composed of pure radioactive isotopes, including iodine-131 and cesium-137, which generated such heat that they warmed the air around them and took flight like hundreds of thousands of tiny hot air balloons. At its heart, it pulsed with some 20 million curies of radioactivity. By the time Soviet scientists finally began regular airborne monitoring near the accident site on Sunday, April 27, a full day after the accident occurred, the invisible monster had slipped away, leaving them ignorant of its size and intensity. Their measurements revealed only its tail. Within 24 hours, it had reached Scandinavia. At midday on Sunday, an automatic monitoring device at the Risø National Laboratory north of Roskilde silently logged the cloud's arrival in Denmark. But because it was a Sunday, the readings went unnoticed. That evening, a soldier at the Finnish National Defense Forces measuring station in Kajaani, southern Finland, recorded an abnormal increase in background radiation. He reported it to the operational center in Helsinki, but no further action was taken. Late that night, the plume encountered rain clouds over Sweden, and the moisture in them began to scavenge and concentrate the contaminants it contained. When the rain finally fell from the clouds, around the city of Gävle, 2 hours' drive north of Stockholm, it had become heavily radioactive. Shortly before 7 o'clock on Monday morning, April 28, Cliff Robinson was eating breakfast in a coffee room of the Forsmark nuclear power station, 65 kilometers southeast of Gävle on the Gulf of Bothnia. Robinson, a 29-year-old Anglo-Swedish technician in the plant's radiochemistry lab, commuted to work each morning on a bus bringing construction workers to Forsmark, where they were building a large underground repository for nuclear waste. When he had finished his coffee, Robinson stepped into the locker room to brush his teeth. On his way back, he passed through a radiation monitoring point, and the alarm bell rang. Still half asleep, the technician was puzzled. He had only just arrived and hadn't yet entered the reactor block. He couldn't possibly be contaminated. But the alarm brought down a member of the plant radiation protection staff, to whom Robinson explained what had happened. He walked through the detector again. Once more, the bell sounded. But on a third attempt, the monitor remained silent. Baffled, the two men decided that the equipment was faulty. Perhaps the alarm threshold had been miscalibrated. The dosimetrist told Robinson to go back to work. The machine could be fixed later. Coincidentally, Robinson's job at the plant was to measure radioactivity at Forsmark 1, within the station building and in what it expelled into the environment. The reactor was only 6 years old, but had been plagued by minor technical faults, and leaking fuel rods had already led to several small radioactive releases that winter. His Monday morning routine took him first to the upper levels of the plant to gather air samples from the vent stack, and then to the lab to analyze them. This took time. At around 9 a.m., he went back downstairs for another coffee. But when he approached the radiation monitoring point, he saw his path blocked by a long line of plant workers, each of whom was setting off the alarm bell. Now more perplexed than ever, Robinson took a shoe from one of the men, placed it in a plastic bag to prevent cross-contamination, and returned to the lab. He put the shoe on the germanium detector, a sensitive tool for measuring gamma rays, and prepared to wait. But the results returned with terrible speed, exploding in steep green peaks across the computer screen. Robinson's heart froze. He had never seen anything like it before. The shoe was intensely contaminated with the entire spectrum of fission products usually found inside the core at Forsmark 1. Cesium-137, cesium-134, and short-lived iodine isotopes, but also a number of other elements including cobalt-60 and neptunium-239. These, he realized, could have originated only with nuclear fuel that had been exposed to the atmosphere. Robinson immediately telephoned his boss, who, fearing the worst, told him to return to the chimney stack and take a fresh set of air samples. At 9:30 a.m., the plant manager, Carl Erik Sandsted, was alerted to the contamination. But the senior staff of Foschmark remained as confused by it as Robinson had been. They couldn't trace it backward to a source within the plant, and yet, given the weather conditions, radiation levels on the ground outside conformed to what they would expect of a major leak from one of the Foschmark reactors. At 10:30, Sandsted ordered approaches to the station sealed off. Local authorities issued a precautionary alert. A warning was broadcast on the radio instructing the population to keep its distance from Foschmark, and police set up roadblocks. 30 minutes later, Robinson was still in the lab, at work on his new batch of samples, when he heard sirens sound throughout the building. The entire plant was being evacuated. But by then, state nuclear and defense agencies in Stockholm had received reports of similarly high levels of contamination at a research facility in Studsvik, 200 kilometers away from Forsmark. Air samples taken in Stockholm also showed elevated radiation and an isotope composition containing graphite particles, suggesting a catastrophic accident in a civilian nuclear reactor, but one of a very different type from those at Forsmark. By 1 p.m., using meteorological calculations developed to help monitor the partial test ban treaty on nuclear weapon trials, the Swedish National Defense Research Institute had also modeled prevailing weather patterns across the Baltic. These established beyond doubt that the radioactive contamination hadn't originated in Forsmark at all. It had come from somewhere outside Sweden, and the wind was blowing from the southeast. At around 11 in the morning, Moscow time, Gaidar Aliyev was in his office in the Kremlin when the phone rang, summoning him to an emergency meeting of the Politburo. As the Deputy Prime Minister of the USSR, Aliyev was one of the most powerful men in the Soviet Union. Once the head of the Azerbaijani KGB and one of only 12 voting members of the Politburo, he held joint responsibility for making the most profound decisions affecting the course of the empire. Yet by Monday morning, even Aliyev knew only the vaguest details about a nuclear accident in Ukraine. Not one word about Chernobyl had appeared in the Soviet press or been reported on radio or television. Authorities in Kiev, without prompting from Moscow, had already acted to suppress awareness of the situation by scientists. On Saturday, after instruments at the Kiev Institute of Botany registered a sharp increase in radiation, KGB officers arrived and sealed the devices to avoid panic and the spreading of provocative rumors. Even so, by the time General Secretary Gorbachev assembled the emergency meeting to discuss what had happened, Aliyev realized that the radiation would soon be detected far beyond the borders of the USSR. The dozen men, including Aliyev, Prime Minister Ryzhkov, Propaganda Chief Alexander Yakovlev, Gorbachev's emerging conservative opponent Yegor Ligachev, and Viktor Chebrikov, the head of the KGB, convened not in the usual Politburo conference room, but in Secretary Gorbachev's gloomy office on the third floor of the Kremlin. In spite of recent renovations, elaborately patterned carpets and a domed ceiling hung with crystal chandeliers, the room was cavernous and uncomfortable. Everyone was nervous. Gorbachev asked simply, "What happened?" Vladimir Dolgich, the Central Committee Secretary in charge of the Soviet energy sector, began by explaining what he knew from his telephone conversations with Shcherbina and the experts in Pripyat. He described an explosion, the destruction of the reactor, and the evacuation of the city. The Air Force was using helicopters to bury the ruined unit in sand, clay, and lead. A cloud of radiation was moving south and west and had already been detected in Lithuania. Information was still scant and conflicting. The armed forces said one thing, scientists another. Now they needed to decide what, or whether, to tell the Soviet people about the accident. For Gorbachev, this was a sudden and unexpected test of the new openness and transparent government he had promised the party conference just a month earlier. Since then, Glasnost had been nothing more than a slogan. "We should make a statement as soon as possible," he said. "We can't procrastinate." Yet the traditional reflexes of secrecy and paranoia were deeply ingrained. The truth about incidents of any kind that might undermine Soviet prestige or provoke public panic had always been suppressed. Even 3 decades after it happened, the 1957 explosion in Mayak had still, officially, never taken place. When a Soviet Air Force pilot mistakenly shot down a Korean Air jumbo jet in 1983, killing all 269 people on board, the USSR initially denied any knowledge of the incident, and Gorbachev's grip on power remained tenuous, vulnerable to the kind of reactionary revolt that had destroyed Khrushchev and his program of liberalization. He had to be careful. Although the official record of the meeting would later appear to show broad agreement on the need to make a public statement about the accident, Gaidar Aliyev insisted it was misleading. According to the Deputy Prime Minister's account, he advocated for immediate and total honesty. All of Europe would soon know that something terrible had happened, and this disaster was simply too big to hide. What was the point in trying to conceal what was already public? But before he could finish, Yegor Ligachev, widely regarded as the second most powerful man in the Kremlin, cut him off. "What do you want?" he asked truculently. "What information do you want to release?" "Come off it," replied Aliyev. "We can't conceal this." Others at the table argued that they didn't have enough information yet to tell the public and feared causing panic. If they released any news at all, it had to be strictly circumscribed. "The statement should be formulated in a way that avoids causing excessive alarm and panic," said Andrei Gromyko, chairman of the Presidium of the Supreme Soviet. And by the time they took a vote, Ligachev had apparently prevailed. The Politburo resolved to take the traditional approach. The assembled party elders drafted an unrevealing 23-word statement to be issued by the state news agency, TASS, and designed to combat what the Central Committee's official spokesman called bourgeois falsification, propaganda, and inventions. Whatever Gorbachev's intentions, it seemed that the old ways were best after all. By 2 p.m. in Stockholm, Swedish state authorities were in unanimous agreement. The country had been contaminated as the result of a major nuclear accident abroad. Just over an hour later, the country's foreign ministry approached the governments of East Germany, Poland, and the USSR to ask if such an incident had taken place on their territory. Soon afterward, the Swedes sent an identical communique to their representatives at the International Atomic Energy Agency. By that time, both Finnish and Danish governments had confirmed that they too had detected radioactive contamination inside their borders. Back in the town of Chernobyl, the single tiny hotel where Viktor Bruhanov had once sat on a bed and sketched plans for his nuclear future, was filling up with exhausted apparatchiks sent from Moscow. Radionuclides continued to boil from the smoldering remains of reactor number 4 as the helicopter pilots of the 17th Airborne Army attempted to cover the reactor and bring the graphite fire raging beneath them under control. Yet the Soviet authorities assured the Swedes that they had no information about any kind of nuclear accident within the USSR. That afternoon in Moscow, the Swedish embassy's science attaché contacted the State Committee for the Utilization of Atomic Energy, the kindly public face of Sredmash, the Ministry of Medium Machine Building. But the committee would neither confirm nor deny a problem with any of their reactors. Early in the evening, at a cocktail party at the Swedish embassy, Ambassador Torsten Urn buttonholed an official of the Soviet Foreign Ministry and asked him directly if he knew of a recent nuclear accident within the USSR. The official told Urn he would make a note of the inquiry, but provided no further comment. Finally, at 8 p.m. on Monday, April 28, almost 3 days after the toxic cloud first rolled into the night sky above Unit 4, Radio Moscow broadcast the TASS statement agreed upon in Gorbachev's office. "An accident has taken place at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant," the announcer read. "One of the atomic reactors has been damaged. Measures are being taken to eliminate the consequences of the accident. Aid is being given to those affected. A government commission has been set up." In its brevity and frugality with the truth, the bulletin was typical of Soviet news reports, a continuation of the way the state had covered conventional industrial accidents for decades. An hour later, Radio Moscow's World Service repeated the announcement in English for foreign listeners and followed it by cataloging the long record of nuclear accidents in the West. Both statements avoided mentioning when exactly the Ukrainian accident might have taken place. At 9:25 p.m. Moscow time, Vremya, the flagship nightly TV news show broadcast throughout the Soviet Union, carried the same 23-word statement, read in the name of the Council of Ministers of the USSR. It was the 21st item of news. There were no pictures. Only the grave expression on the face of the anchor and the mention of the Council of Ministers suggested that something extraordinary might have happened. The following morning, Tuesday, April 29, the press in Moscow remained entirely silent about the accident. In Ukraine, the daily papers in Kiev reported the news, but their editors did their best to keep it quiet. Pravda Ukraini printed a short report at the bottom of page 3, beneath an article recounting the story of two pensioners struggling to have telephones installed in their homes. Rubotnicha Hyzeta, the Ukrainian Workers' Daily, took care to bury its Chernobyl story below the Soviet soccer league tables and coverage of a chess tournament. Back in the Kremlin, General Secretary Gorbachev had convened the second extraordinary meeting of the Politburo in 2 days, once more at 10:30 in the morning. Now, he was concerned that the initial response to the developing catastrophe had been flat-footed. Radiation was still spreading, elevated levels had already been reported in Scandinavia, and the Poles were asking awkward questions. Was it possible that contamination could reach Leningrad or Moscow? Vladimir Dolgich gave his colleagues the latest news. The plume of radioisotopes drifting from Chernobyl had divided into three traces, heading north, south, and west, and the Ministry of the Interior had cordoned off an area of at least 10 kilometers around the plant, but the levels of radiation released from the reactor were falling. Chebrikov, the KGB chief, disagreed. His sources saw no indication that the radiation situation was improving. In fact, they were facing disaster. Further evacuations in the area were already underway. There were almost 200 victims of the accident hospitalized in Moscow, and Vladimir Sherbitsky, the Ukrainian premier, had reported outbreaks of panic in his republic. Everyone present agreed that they must seal up the reactor completely as quickly as possible. To take control of the situation, they moved to set up a special 7-person operations group, headed by Prime Minister Ryzhkov, and including Dolgich, Chebrikov, the Minister of the Interior, and the Minister of Defense. The group granted emergency powers to command all party and ministerial authorities throughout the Union, would coordinate the disaster response from Moscow, placing all resources of the centralized state at the disposal of the government commission in Chernobyl. Discussion turned once more to what to tell the world about what had happened. "The more honest we are, the better," Gorbachev said, suggesting that they should at least provide specific information to the governments of the Soviet satellite states, to Washington, D.C., and London. "You're right," said Anatoly Dobrynin, recently appointed to the Central Committee after 20 years as the Soviet ambassador to the United States. "After all, I'm sure the photos are already on Reagan's desk." They agreed to cable statements to their ambassadors in world capitals including Havana, Warsaw, Bonn, and Rome. "Should we give information to our people?" asked Aliyev. "Perhaps," Ligachev replied. On Tuesday evening, Vremya broadcast a new statement issued in the name of the Soviet Council of Ministers. This conceded that two people had been killed as a result of an explosion at the Chernobyl plant, that a section of the reactor building had been destroyed, and that Pripyat had been evacuated. There was no mention of a radioactive release. This time, the report was relegated to sixth place, behind the latest encouraging news about the mighty Soviet economy. By then, the rest of the world's media had the scent of a spectacular catastrophe behind the Iron Curtain, and Chernobyl had become headline news in the West. Newspapers and TV networks threw their correspondents into a hunt for more details, no matter how vaporous their sources. Denied permission to travel to Ukraine and faced with a bureaucratic wall of silence, the Foreign Press Corps in Moscow did what they could with scant material. Luther Whittington of the wire service United Press International, only recently arrived in the USSR, had bumped into a Ukrainian woman in Red Square just a few weeks earlier, who he believed had contacts in the emergency services. Whittington telephoned the woman at home in Kiev and understood her to say that 80 people had been killed immediately, and an additional 2,000 had died on the way to the hospital as a result of the explosion. No independent confirmation could be found for these claims, and one of Whittington's Moscow colleagues, Nicholas Danilov of the U.S. News and World Report, would later be convinced that the UPI man's Russian was so primitive that he might have misunderstood what his source had said. Nonetheless, it was a sensational story that flashed immediately across the international wires with predictable results. 2,000 die in Nukemare. Soviets appeal for help as N-plant burns out of control, screamed the front page of the New York Post on Tuesday, the same morning that news of the accident was being modestly tucked away beneath the sports results in Kiev. In London, the following day, the Daily Mail went with 2,000 dead in atom horror. That night, this lurid death toll became the lead story on TV news across the United States. A Pentagon source told NBC that satellite images of the plant had revealed such devastation that thousands of deaths were inevitable, and 2,000 seemed about right since 4,000 worked at the plant. Soon afterward, U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz received a secret intelligence assessment describing the Soviet claim of only 2 fatalities as preposterous. Meanwhile, the radioactive cloud had continued north and spread west to envelop all of Scandinavia before the weather stagnated and the contamination drifted south over Poland, forming a wedge that moved down into Germany. Heavy rain then deposited a dense band of radiation that reached all the way from Czechoslovakia into southern France. The West German and Swedish governments lodged furious complaints with Moscow over its failure to promptly notify them of the accident, and requested more information about what had happened, but to no avail. Instead, Soviet embassy officials contacted scientists in both Bonn and Stockholm, seeking advice on nuclear firefighting, especially tips on how to extinguish burning graphite. The widening rumors, experts' public speculation about a reactor meltdown, and now, more terrifying still, the possibility of a radioactive fire that could not be put out, spread panic throughout Europe. In Denmark, pharmacies quickly sold out of potassium iodide tablets. In Sweden, imports of food from the USSR and 5 Eastern European countries were banned. A radioactive particle was reportedly discovered in a nursing mother's breast milk, and government switchboards jammed with calls from people asking if it was safe to drink water or even go outside. In communist Poland, where state television assured the public that they were not in danger, authorities nonetheless distributed stable iodine to children and restricted the sale of dairy products. In Holland, a Dutch radio ham reported listening in to a shortwave exchange in which someone in the Kiev region claimed that not one, but 2 reactors in Chernobyl were melting down. "The world has no idea of the catastrophe," the Ukrainian pleaded through the static. "Help us!" Soviet spokesmen dismissed these stories as opportunistic Western propaganda, but confounded by the state's reflexive secrecy, had few facts with which to fight back. On Wednesday evening, Radio Moscow admitted that in addition to the 2 deaths, another 197 people had been hospitalized as a result of the accident, but 49 of them had already been released after checkups. "The radiation situation," the announcer added obliquely, "was improving." A single photograph of the plant, said to have been taken soon after the explosion, was also broadcast on television, demonstrating that it had not been destroyed entirely. At the same time, Radio Kiev announced its intention to stifle Western rumors of thousands of fatalities. Meanwhile, KGB chief Chebrikov notified his superiors that he was battling the bourgeois conspiracy at its source. He was, he told the Party Central Committee, undertaking measures to control the activities of foreign diplomats and correspondents, limit their ability to gather information on the accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, and foil attempts to use it for stoking the anti-Soviet propaganda campaign in the West. That same day in Moscow, Nicholas Danilov found that he was unable to telex his dispatches back to U.S. News and World Report headquarters in Washington, D.C. He made arrangements instead to use the machine at the UPI office, 20 minutes drive across town. As he was getting ready to leave, Danilov looked out of the window to see several men tugging at the cables beneath an open manhole in the courtyard, apparently attempting to sever his remaining communications with the outside world. It didn't help. If anything, the Soviet attempts to hamper Western reporting made the rumors worse. By the end of the week, the New York Post was going to press with unconfirmed reports from Ukraine that 15,000 people had been killed in the accident, their bodies buried in mass graves excavated in a nuclear waste disposal site. In the headquarters of the government commission in Pripyat, the emergency had continued to escalate. On Sunday evening, the young Air Force commander, General Antoshkin, went to the White House to report the progress of his pilots' bombing operation to Chairman Boris Sherbina. Using just 3 helicopters, they had managed to dump 10 tons of boron and 80 tons of sand into Unit 4 by nightfall. It was a heroic effort in terrible conditions, but Sherbina was unimpressed. Such quantities were a pathetic show in the face of a planetary catastrophe. 80 tons of sand for a reactor like this is like hitting an elephant with a BB gun, he said. They would have to do better. Antoshkin ordered in heavy-lift helicopters, including the giant Mi-26, the most powerful helicopter in the world, nicknamed Korova, the flying cow, and capable of carrying up to 20 tons in a single load. He stayed up that night, trying to devise ways to increase the effectiveness of the operation. The next day, the commission drafted the population of several towns and villages in the nearby countryside into the effort to fill bags with sand. Antoshkin improvised an air traffic control system to speed up loading and requested decommissioned braking parachutes from MiG-23 fighter jets for use as improvised cargo nets. In the meantime, the flight engineers continued to heft the bags into Unit 4 by hand and remained almost entirely unprotected from the gamma rays rising from the ruined building. The crews flew from dawn to dusk every day, and at night returned to their airfield in Chernikov to decontaminate their machines, discard their uniforms, and scrub radioactive dust from their bodies in a sauna. But it proved almost impossible to entirely remove the radiation from the helicopters, and when they returned each morning to begin a new mission, the airmen found that the grass beneath their parked aircraft had turned yellow overnight. Most crews flew a total of 10 to 15 sorties over the reactor, making two or three bombing runs each time. But the first pilots did even more. One returned 76 times to reactor number 4 in the first 3 days. According to Antoshkin, when they touched down in the landing zones after the second or third sortie, some flight engineers leapt from their machines to vomit into the bushes on the riverbank. By the morning of Tuesday, April 29, the work of Antoshkin's crews seemed to be having an effect. Radioactivity escaping from the reactor began to fall, and the temperature dropped from more than 1,000 degrees to 500 degrees centigrade. But radiation levels in the deserted streets of Pripyat had now become so dangerous that the government commission was forced to withdraw to a new headquarters 19 kilometers away in Chernobyl town. The territory immediately surrounding the plant, an area roughly 1.5 kilometers in diameter, which officials soon began calling the Osobaya Zona, or Special Zone, was highly contaminated with both debris and nuclear fallout. Scientists, specialists, and those operators who had stayed behind to tend to the needs of the remaining 3 reactors at the station now approached it only in armored personnel carriers. In Moscow, Prime Minister Ryzhkov chaired the first meeting of the Politburo Operations Group that afternoon, and the hammer of the centrally planned economy immediately began to swing. Academician Legasov and the other scientists calculated that a total of 2,000 tons of lead would eventually be needed to help smother the graphite fire, but Legasov was afraid to ask for such an enormous quantity of a scarce resource on short notice. Sherbina, an old hand in the ways of the system, went ahead and ordered 6,000 tons just in case, and Ryzhkov had every train carrying lead on the Soviet rail network redirected toward Chernobyl. The first 2,500 tons arrived the next morning. By the time the light failed on Tuesday night, Antoshkin's helicopter crews had dropped another 190 tons of sand and clay inside the walls of Unit 4. But the fire blazed on, and radionuclides continued to pour from the wreckage of the reactor. A scientific report revealed to the party in Kiev that levels of background radiation in the Ukrainian cities of Rovno and Zhytomyr, more than 100 kilometers to the west and southwest of the plant respectively, had already increased almost 20-fold. The regional civil defense leaders had made preparations for evacuating the settlements within a 10-kilometer radius of the plant, 10,000 people in all, and pleaded with Sherbina to give permission for the operation to proceed. But to their consternation, he refused. The next morning, a shipment of parachutes was delivered to Chernobyl by helicopter. Not surplus equipment, as General Antoshkin had suggested, but 14,000 brand-new paratroop canopies requisitioned from airborne detachments all over the USSR. When Antoshkin conducted tests, he discovered that each chute could carry as much as 1.5 tons without breaking. By sunset, his crews had managed to hit the reactor with another 1,000 tons of absorbance. When the general delivered his report that night, he saw Sherbina's face brighten for the first time since the bombing operation had begun. On Wednesday, April 30, the eve of the annual May Day celebrations, which would fill the streets of towns and cities throughout the USSR with parades and rallies, the wind blowing over the Chernobyl plant shifted once more. This time it turned almost due south, carrying energetic alpha and beta contamination directly toward Kiev, along with dangerously high levels of gamma radiation in the form of iodine-131, the radioisotope that concentrates dangerously in the thyroid gland, particularly in children. At exactly 1 o'clock that afternoon, radiation levels on the streets of the city began to rise abruptly. By nightfall, recorded radioactivity on Nauki Prospect, near the heart of Kiev, on the eastern bank of the Dnieper, had reached as high as 2.2 millirentgen per hour, or 22 microsieverts per hour, hundreds of times higher than normal. The progress of the radioactive cloud had been tracked by the weather monitoring equipment of the USSR State Committee for Hydrometeorology, which that day sent classified reports of its findings to Prime Minister Ryzhkov in Moscow, but also to the leaders of the Ukrainian Communist Party in Kiev, including First Secretary Shcherbitsky. Inside the Ukrainian Ministry of Health, the Republic's senior doctors, normally orderly and restrained, started to panic. They discussed the need to take precautions against radioactive aerosols and to broadcast a warning to the population. But they took no action. Valentin Zagursky, the chairman of the Kiev City Executive Committee, the city mayor, also responsible for coordinating its civil defense, had worked at a factory manufacturing gamma measurement tools and was familiar with the dangers of radiation. He tried to convince Shcherbitsky to cancel the big May Day parade they had scheduled to pass through the center of the city the following morning, but the first secretary told him that the orders had come down from Moscow. Not only would the parade take place, but they were all expected to attend and bring their families with them to demonstrate that there was no reason for anyone in Kiev to panic. The following morning, preparations for the parade got underway as usual. Party organizers had hung banners and spectators filled the streets. At 10 o'clock, the first secretary was scheduled to open the parade from his position in the center of the tall reviewing stand overlooking the square of the October Revolution. But with only 10 minutes to go, he was nowhere to be seen. His central spot on the platform remained empty. The members of the Ukrainian Politburo, the city mayor, and the other assembled dignitaries became agitated. No one else but the first secretary had the right to start the procession, and he had never been late for the May Day parade in all his years in office. At last, his chaika tore down the hill toward the rostrum and pulled up sharply. Shcherbitsky climbed from the back seat, red-faced and cursing. "I told them that we can't possibly conduct the parade on Kerchatik," he muttered to the assembled dignitaries. "It's not like Red Square. This is a ravine. There's radiation pooling here. He told me you'll put your party card on the table if you bungle the parade." The furious first secretary left no one in any doubt about whom he had been speaking to. The only man in the union with the authority to threaten him with expulsion from the party was Gorbachev himself. "To hell with it," Shcherbitsky said. "Let's start the parade." Soon after 10 o'clock, the cheering crowds began their march down the broad avenue of Kerchatik. The sun was warm, the atmosphere festive. There were seas of red banners and biers of brightly colored peonies and spring shades of magenta, yellow, and blue. Ranks of party veterans clad in gray suits and scarlet sashes. The girls of the Young Pioneers, the Communist Girl Scouts, in white uniforms and red neckerchiefs, waving boughs of cherry blossom. And young dancers in the embroidered blouses and billowing charivari pants of traditional Ukrainian Cossack dress, swinging arm in arm in extended lines or spinning in tight circles. Carrying their children or leading them by the hand, the citizens of Kiev marched in dense blocks beneath the boulevard's famous chestnut trees, clutching balloons and bearing placards depicting Soviet and Ukrainian party leaders, past the fountains of the square of the October Revolution, where six-story portraits of Marx, Engels, and Lenin gazed impassively from the grimy facades of the apartment buildings. Shcherbitsky, who waved and smiled paternally from the rostrum as his subjects passed, had made some concessions to the perils of the fallout carried on the breeze. Instead of 4 hours, the parade lasted only two. Instead of between 4,000 and 5,000 people from every district, party organizers gathered only 2,000. But the first secretary ensured that his grandson Vladimir participated in the march. Kiev Mayor Zagursky brought his 3 sons and 2 grandchildren. Some on the rostrum that morning had armed themselves with dosimeters and consulted them discreetly, but constantly. Others simply stole occasional glances at the sky. Later, when the wind changed direction again, threatening to carry the plume of radionuclides north toward Moscow, Soviet pilots flew repeated missions to seed the clouds with silver iodide, designed to precipitate moisture from the air. The capital was spared, but 300 kilometers to the south, peasants watched as hundreds of square kilometers of fertile farmland in Belarus were lashed with black rain. In Moscow, the May Day procession swept through Red Square just as it did every year, and a carnival atmosphere filled the city. Workers from all over the Soviet Union paraded 9 abreast past Lenin's red granite mausoleum, waving paper carnations and scarlet banners as Gorbachev and the other members of the Politburo looked on. But afterward, Prime Minister Ryzhkov convened another urgent meeting of the Chernobyl Operations Group, attended by more than a dozen senior ministers, including those representing health, defense, and foreign affairs, as well as Ligachev and Chebrikov, the ideological and KGB chiefs of the USSR. Leading the nuclear scientists at the table was Anatoly Alexandrov, head of the Kurchatov Institute. As the festivities continued in the streets outside, the group confronted the emergencies spiraling from Chernobyl. First, they heard how the scale of the crisis had overwhelmed the Soviet health ministry. Ryzhkov relieved the ministry's chief of his responsibility for the medical response and handed control to the deputy health minister, Oleg Shepin. Ryzhkov instructed him to provide the group with daily reports of the number of victims of the accident hospitalized throughout the USSR and how many of them had been diagnosed with radiation sickness. Despite their relocation from Pripyat, Shcherbina, Legasov, and the other members of the government commission had already been exposed to dangerous levels of radiation and had to be replaced as soon as possible. They would need to order medical supplies from the West and pay for them in hard currency. The group also had to give serious consideration to foreign doctors offering to come to Moscow to assist in treating radiation victims. Marshal Akhromeyev, the chief of the general staff of the USSR, reported that Ministry of Defense troops had begun decontamination work in the area immediately surrounding the Chernobyl plant, but more men were urgently needed as the radiation continued to spread. It was also clear that attempts to conceal the truth of what had happened from the international community seemed only to have made matters worse. Western diplomats and reporters were deluging Moscow with protests and questions about the nature and proportions of the accident. Ryzhkov resolved to organize a press conference for foreign journalists and delegated the details to Shcherbina, Alexandrov, and Andranik Petresians, chairman of the Soviet State Committee for the Utilization of Atomic Energy. Ryzhkov now assembled the members of the Replacement Government Commission and gave them orders to fly to Chernobyl the following day. This new team would be led by Ivan Salayev, the 55-year-old former Soviet Minister of Aviation Industry. Its chief scientist, intended to replace Valery Legasov, was Evgeny Velikov, Legasov's next-door neighbor and rival to succeed old man Alexandrov as head of the Kurchatov Institute. When the meeting concluded, Ryzhkov went to see Gorbachev in his office. The Prime Minister and Ligachev, the Conservative Party boss, had decided that the time had come for them to visit the scene of the accident. Ryzhkov told the General Secretary of his intentions and waited for Gorbachev to say he would join them. But apparently nothing could have been further from the Soviet leader's mind. The next day, Ryzhkov and Ligachev, along with the head of the KGB, flew to Kiev without him. Accompanied by Shcherbitsky, the Ukrainian First Secretary and the Prime Minister of Ukraine, the men from the Politburo flew by helicopter to the Chernobyl plant. They stopped in a village where evacuees from Pripyat had been temporarily resettled. Ryzhkov found the people he met to be strangely calm and suspected that they were still ignorant of the magnitude of the disaster enfolding them. When they asked when they would be allowed to return home, the ministers couldn't say. They were told to wait and be patient. At 2 p.m., Ryzhkov and Ligachev sat for a briefing in the regional headquarters of the party in Chernobyl town. Talk turned to evacuating the settlements surrounding the plant. Shcherbina told Ryzhkov that evacuation of the 10-kilometer zone had just begun. On the table were reconnaissance maps of the area around the nuclear plant, the result of separate military, meteorological, and geological surveys, all top secret and marked to show the spread of the radioactive fallout from the plant. Overlaid upon one another, they showed a ragged blot centered on Pripyat and extending to the southeast where it covered Chernobyl. It crossed the border into Belarus to the north, and a long trace of heavy fallout extended due west, forming a forked tongue reaching out toward the towns of Vilcha and Polyeska. The contamination had spread far beyond the boundaries of the 10-kilometer zone, and now imperiled tens of thousands of people across a vast area, in some places as far as 30 kilometers from the plant. Prime Minister Ryzhkov examined the maps carefully. Some locations seemed safe for now, others were clearly not, and in some villages the fallout was patchy and varied from street to street. Clearly, something had to be done, but it was hard to know exactly what. Everyone in the room was awaiting his decision. "We will evacuate the population from the 30-kilometer zone," Ryshkov said at last. "From all of it?" someone asked. "From all of it," the Prime Minister replied, and circled the area on the map for emphasis. "And start immediately." 11. The China Syndrome. From high up on the roof of the Hotel Polesia, Colonel Lubomir Mimka had an excellent view. The center of Pripyat spread out before him in a bright panorama, from the glinting constructivist sculpture above the entrance to the music school on his left, to the row of colored pennants fluttering above the plaza to his right. He and his radio operator had the city to themselves. The hotel was empty, and even the birds had left, the twittering of sparrows that had once danced through the branches of the poplar and acacia trees on the streets below had long since ceased. Exploring the banquet hall downstairs, the two men had discovered a mysterious black carpet stretching from wall to wall, and it was only when the radio man had begun to cross it, sweltering in his rubber chemical protection suit, his boots crunching beneath him, that they realized the floor was covered with thousands of dozing flies, apparently intoxicated by radiation. Unspooling a fire hose from the wall, they washed the floor clean and moved down there when the heat of the sun and the toll of the radioactivity upstairs became too much to bear. But from the 8th-story rooftop, framed by the heavy concrete supports of the outdoor terrace, Colonel Mimka's sighting position on reactor number 4, just over 3 kilometers away but clearly visible on the horizon, was perfect. Almost from the beginning of the bombing operation, the Air Force had been using the hotel as an improvised control tower. But now General Antoshkin had also devised a system that enabled his pilots to drop hundreds of tons of material into the burning reactor every day. As one helicopter after another clattered into its run over Unit 4, Mimka watched from the roof and issued final instructions to the pilots over the radio, estimating distance and trajectory by eye. There were now dozens of machines involved, the medium-heavy Mi-8, the heavy Mi-6, and the super-heavy Mi-26, taking off in a continuous carousel from 3 separate landing zones. Each carried at least one upturned parachute slung beneath its belly, filled with bags of sand or clay by civil defense troops and work gangs drawn from the local settlements. Lifting off from the field in a whirlwind of dust, they approached the reactor at 100 kilometers per hour. Mimka waited until they were 300 meters from their target, judging their position against the pylons rising from the transformer yards around the station. He gave the order ready, and the pilot moved his finger to the release button. 2 or 3 seconds passed. Mimka said drop, the pilot released the payload, and the helicopter, suddenly unburdened, turned quickly away, before returning to collect another cargo from the landing zone. Mimka rose at 4 o'clock each morning and was given a blood test for radiation exposure with his breakfast. He was in the air at 6 and took a reconnaissance flight over the reactor before being dropped in the square outside the hotel. He remained on the roof until the light gave out sometime after 9 p.m., and he took the last flight of the day himself to log a second set of radiation and temperature readings over reactor number 4. Then there was decontamination and dinner at 10, followed by debriefing. Sleep came finally at midnight, and 4 hours later, a cadet was shaking him awake again. General Antoshkin had imposed an exposure limit of 22 rem on his men, although many routinely underreported it in order to keep flying longer. They were issued both bitter potassium iodide tablets and a sweet medicinal paste, shipped in from a pharmaceutical plant in Leningrad intended to help combat radiation, which they called pastilla. When the first shipments of lead arrived, in ingots and sheets and 10-kilogram bags of Hunter's shotgun pellets delivered from stores with the price tag still on them, the pilots improvised their own protection. They lined the floor of the cabins with the 4 and 5 millimeter thick sheets and filled the wells of their seats, designed to accommodate parachute packs, from the bags of shot. They even had a rhyme about it. Если хочешь быть отцом, закрывай яйцо свинцом. If you want to be a dad, cover your balls in lead. Even as the bombardment continued, academician Legosov and the other scientists sent down from the Kurchatov Institute of Atomic Energy and the Ministry of Medium Machine Building in Moscow still had little idea what was going on inside the burning reactor. The pilots were now targeting a red glow they could see inside Unit 4, but no one could be certain exactly what was causing it. Back in the capital, physicists were hauled into their offices at the Kurchatov Institute late at night to help calculate how much uranium fuel might still be left inside the ruins of Reactor Number 4. And 5 or 6 times every day, scientists joined the helicopter crews flying over the accident site to monitor radiation levels in the air and estimate the heat of the burning core by analyzing the radioactive isotopes in the atmosphere. They took surface temperature readings of the reactor using a Swedish-made thermal imaging camera. They watched as the pilots' payloads plunged toward their mark and saw shaggy mushroom-shaped clouds of black radioactive smoke and dust rise 100 meters into the air, hanging there before being snatched by the breeze and swept away across the countryside. As dusk fell, a beautiful crimson halo rose above the building. Looking down at the incandescent mass on his reconnaissance flights above the reactor in the evening gloaming, Colonel Mimko was reminded of the lava he had seen among the volcanoes of Kamchatka in the Soviet Far East. At the very start, one member of the Kurchatov group in Chernobyl, the RBMK reactor specialist Konstantin Fedelenko, tried to tell Legasov that the whole helicopter operation might be misguided. He had seen for himself that each of the cargo drops into the shattered building was hurling heavy radioactive particles into the atmosphere. And, given the small size of the target, partially concealed by the tilted concrete lid of Elena, and the speed of the pilot's approach, there seemed little chance that any of the sand or lead was making it into the eye of the reactor vault itself. But Legasov disagreed. He told Fedelenko that it was too late to change course. "The decision has been made," he said. The two scientists argued for a few minutes until Fedelenko eventually admitted the full extent of his fears, that all their efforts to quench the graphite fire were a total waste of time. He said they should just let the radioactive blaze burn itself out. Legasov didn't want to listen. He insisted that they had to take immediate action, whether it was effective or not. "People won't understand if we do nothing," Legasov said. "We have to be seen to be doing something." Day after day, the volume of material dumped into the reactor mounted. On Monday, April 28, the helicopter crews flew 93 sorties and dropped a total of 300 tons. The next day, they managed 186 sorties and 750 tons. On the morning of Wednesday, April 30, they began dropping lead, and that day blanketed Unit 4 with more than 1,000 tons of absorbents, including sand, clay, and dolomite. In the landing zones, the men of Special Battalion 731, a hastily created new formation of army reservists mustered overnight across the Kiev region, worked for 16 hours a day beneath the whirling blades of the helicopters, piling sacks into parachute canopies and securing them to the cargo hardpoints of the aircraft. The hot weather and the rotor wash created an almost constant tornado of radioactive dust reaching 30 meters into the air. The soldiers wore no protective clothing, not even pedal respirators. The dust filled their eyes and mouths and caked beneath their clothes. At night, they slept fitfully in their irradiated uniforms in tents beside the Pripyat. At dawn, they rose to start again. As the airborne attack went on, the levels of radionuclides issuing from the reactor continued their downward trajectory, from 6 million curies of radiation on Sunday to 5 million on Monday, 4 million on Tuesday, and 3 million on Wednesday. By the end of the day, the incandescent spot the airmen had been targeting seemed to have been extinguished. On the evening of the next day, Thursday, May 1, General Antoshkin reported to Boris Sherbina that his pilots had bombarded Reactor No. 4 with more than 1,200 tons of lead, sand, and other materials. Some members of the government commission got to their feet and applauded. Sherbina graced the general with a rare smile. Then he set a new target for the following day: 1,500 tons. But by the next evening, Valery Legasov and the team of scientists analyzing the data from Unit 4 had made a horrifying and apparently inexplicable discovery. Instead of continuing to fall, the radioactive releases from the reactor had now suddenly begun to increase again, doubling from 3 million to 6 million curies overnight. The temperature of the burning core, too, was rising rapidly. By Thursday night, Legasov's estimates suggested that it was already approaching 1,700 degrees centigrade. The academicians now feared that the uranium dioxide fuel and zirconium cladding remaining inside the vault of reactor number 4 had become so hot that they had started to fuse into a mass of radioactive lava in what amounted to a total core meltdown. Worse still,